What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
Today, we are back from a bit of a break, a bit of a summer break. How are you doing, Sherlyn?
Jet lagged.
Oh, man. Yeah, you were in Singapore, right? Like, you all the way back over. How long were you in Singapore?
It was under a week, but including travel, I was gone for about a week and basically missed 2 days of like recording this podcast. So that's why we missed this many episodes.
How
everybody.
Dare you to see your family, to have good food at the hawker stand. How dare you? That's also a really fast trip for such a long flight, Sherlyn. So you're such a trooper. Mm. But this week, folks, we are coming back into the swing of things. Sherlyn is going to talk about her review of the Samsung Galaxy Ring. We're going to talk about COSA passing the Senate. This is something we've talked about before, the Kids Online Safety Act. And we're going to talk a bit about the AI gadget Friend, which debuted this week with a really, I don't know, cheesy trailer and had a lot of us laughing. But we also have some interviews with folks, too. We have Avi Shiffman, the CEO of Friend, who talked with me about kind of what he's trying to accomplish with this device and why he moved away from making it like a productivity focused thing like the Humane AI Pin or the Rabbit R1. And joining us to talk about COSA is India McKinney, Director of Federal Affairs at the EFF. They're going to talk about why this bill has a huge amount of privacy concerns. People are worried about censorship online because of this bill and the things it can, you know, it can stop online. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We love your feedback. We love questions. And anything you send us can be mentioned on the show. So if you want to be internet famous for an episode or something, just shout us out. We also typically live stream the show on Thursday mornings around 10:45 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel. So join us for that. You can talk with the chat crew. You can see us do some Q&A live on camera today. Sherlyn's going to show off the Galaxy Ring. Boy, it's round. I don't know what else you can show off with that thing, Sherlyn, but we'll talk a bit about that thing. Let's get right into it, actually. So, Sherlyn, you reviewed the Galaxy Ring. This was a device I was not super amped about, but Samsung, I feel like Samsung was really leaning on it because Apple hasn't done it yet. There aren't too many other smart rings out there except for the Oura. How do you feel about this thing?
Okay, so to your point, it on its own, the Ring doesn't do a lot. And it's really basic. Like, it's a $400 device that's got a bunch of sensors on it. It will track your heart rate, heart rate variability, skin temperature, you know, steps.
It's $400? That didn't click with me until now. You could get an Apple Watch for that price.
Yeah, it is expensive. So you have to be okay with the fact that you're paying a lot of money for something that on its own, once again, doesn't do a lot. And the thing is, you with the Ring, you leave it there to passively collect data on you. And then you spend most of your time, if you're like me and interested in those, you know, bits of information, you spend most of your time on the Samsung Health app on the phone. And I mean, I like it. I think it's very comfortable to wear, partly because it's so pared down. It doesn't have a lot. It's not as heavy as the Oura Ring. In fact, it's actually half the weight.
The Oura Ring is kind of a thick boy. Like, if you look at that thing, it's chunky.
Much thicker. And in fact, with the Samsung Galaxy Ring, I felt like, so mine is a size 7, which is the third smallest size Samsung offers. And that's pretty similar to my actual ring size, for those who are wondering. But like, I would find even throughout the day as your body changes, it never gets too tight. In fact, like it might actually be too loose at times, which is important because that affects my blood oxygen readings at night, which I'll get into later. But first and foremost, the Galaxy Ring is a passive health data tracking device. And that's, you know, if it's right for you and if you have the $400 you want to spend on that, go for it. I think there are people out there that are looking for a low-key, low-profile gadget like this. Mark Dell in the chat asked a very good question, and it's something that is actually crucial in my review, which is, is there any reason to buy or get the Smart Ring if you have a smartwatch? For me, I found in my testing that the ideal combination is a ring and a watch, if I had a crap ton of money. I would wear the ring to track passive things like sleeping, low-level activities, so like neat stuff. And then the watch I would use for tracking workouts or when I'm like out and about. And I'm more likely to want to get notifications on a wrist-worn screen. Uh-huh. That really, like, I found that when I was wearing both the Watch Ultra and the Galaxy Ring to be like the best combo when I was out and about. because I don't want to wear that goddamn Watch Ultra at home. It's so huge.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, that device may not have been meant for you, just like the Apple Watch Ultra, right? Like, that is just a big honking thing.
I will say the Watch Ultra never felt as big as the Galaxy one, because don't forget what Samsung's doing with the Galaxy Watch Ultra is to stuff a circular screen into a squarish body. So it just adds bulk. You know, it doesn't need to be as bulky as it is, the Apple Watch Ultra isn't as bulky, but...
It kind of fits the shape of your wrist more by being a little more squarish, I guess. That's a good question, though, by the way, from Mark Dell, is that I think the thing facing wearables, I remember when a lot of the wearable stuff, when Fitbit first came out, when Jawbone had their early stuff, people were like, oh, this is so cool. I could track my activity. I could do all sorts of stuff. And the constant question was, well, why do I need this in addition to my smartphone, right?
Right.
And now the question is, why do you need the smart ring? Likely in addition to an Apple, to a smartwatch. And then algebra for that, like the equation for that math is too annoying and too difficult for most consumers. It just seems like these things don't fully justify themselves yet.
I mean, I think that one thing I said in my review is that this thing doesn't do much, and that's okay by me. And I will point out that what it doesn't do is kind of frustrating. So, but to that point where, if you do have that, you've decided, I like this, setup, right? Wearing a ring and a watch. The Samsung Health app is actually not bad at, parsing and putting together all of your data on the one page. You don't have to keep jumping back and forth between two windows or apps. To just get all your data, it just all adds up, right? So one of the things that Samsung introduced alongside the Galaxy Ring and the Watch Ultra is its Galaxy AI-enabled health, features like the energy score, which, by the way, Garmin and Fitbit has been doing forever and ever. But
what is an energy score? What is that?
It's based on how much sleep you got the night before and how much activity you did the day before, and it tells you how ready you are to, tackle the next day. So every morning you get a new energy score after, Samsung's calculated your sleep and your activity from the day before. And it's today you can take it easy, or you should take it easy. Or then you had a lot of rest and you did basically nothing yesterday, you little lazy pig, you do more today. It doesn't say those words, but you know what I mean? Your energy score being high means you can go on and go on a big hike or whatever.
I kind of love this idea, by the way. I wish we had the actual tech to make this biologically fully accurate, right? That would involve an implant or something, so you would have a little Mega Man meter on your wrist, I have full hearts today, I have a full life bar, let's take on the world.
We're all gaming characters now. But the thing is, the main issue with this, and we're coming back again to the problem here, which is the Galaxy Watch Ultra. You mother piece of, it's like the Galaxy Watch Ultra is not only a chonky boy, it's like a chonkster on the scale of that we've established in previous episodes of the Engadget podcast. The watch itself, I have confirmed with Samsung last week, does not have wear detection. It does not know whether it's on your wrist or not. This thing the Apple Watch does, okay? The Apple Watch knows all the watches, Ultra.
It seems like a very basic feature for any smartwatch.
Yes, it is a basic feature. And here's where the bigger problem with that is, right? Not only is it just chilling, when it's not on your wrist, therefore just draining its own battery, it's also randomly detecting workouts when you're not wearing it. So if you put it, like I did, in my purse, and I took a cab ride or something, it was like, oh, you've been biking.
We're tumbling.
I'm like, no, I haven't. I haven't, bro. No. And the other thing is, it doesn't have wear detection, so that one of the key features of the Galaxy Watch Ultra is how when you press down that orange quick button for 5 seconds, the emergency siren will go off. Yeah, do you know the number of times in my testing where the siren's just going off in my backpack somewhere and I'm embarrassed in the Singapore airport? I have a video of this. My mom was like, what is that sound, sending me off too, by the way, to go home to US. And we were like, what is that sound? And it's in my bag, the Samsung Galaxy Watch Ultra slowly dying and still screaming. At 2% battery, screaming with the emergency SOS. So that was frustrating. But back to the point with the energy score, because that info from the Galaxy Watch Ultra was so inaccurate and messing up my entire activity history because of those phantom workouts, that my energy score was like, oh, you worked out too much yesterday. You took a lot of bike rides. Just don't work out as much today. I was like, huh? That's weird, right? It's not a problem if you take the time to go in and read and figure out what happened. But if you're just looking at your energy score and like that's all you look at, you'll be like getting very inaccurate information. So that's just one of like my bad experiences during testing. It's not a Galaxy Ring issue. It's a Galaxy Watch Ultra feeding into Samsung Health. It's an ecosystem issue,
because if you had another Galaxy Watch, right, not even the Ultra, like you would still have the same data like management issue between both of them, right?
Yes. Yeah. So, and Martel's like, good to know that I can stick my watch on my cat to try to boost my score. That's not, boost your activity score, but not your energy score or your readiness score. Do Name Charlie in the chat ask a good question, which is something I want to bring up too. How good is the sleep tracking? So I like the sleep tracking. It was good. It was like mostly accurate, right? I think as far as I can tell you how accurate my sleep stages are, right? It'll tell you how many hours you spent in REM, how much time you spent in deep, blah, blah, blah. Very standard stuff by now in the wearables and fitness sleep tracking market. I used to complain that companies like Fitbit, Google, even Apple didn't do enough of contextualizing the insight you gain from how much time you spend in each sleep stage. And now I think we're better, but like Samsung's kind of my first experience with this improved data. So not only does it tell me like you spent 11% of your sleep cycles in deep, it also will say like this is a good amount for, you know, restoring this, restoring that. It compares well to other people in this age group. Ideal amount of time is this. So like within one page, I can get a better sense of how well I slept, how much recovery I got overnight, which I like. I think that's more important than like whether exactly to the minute was it accurate about tracking how much time I was asleep.
Was this the most comfortable like sleep device you've had? Because that's always been your like complaint with sleep trackers, right?
Yeah. So this thing, I mean, maybe the fact that it's slightly loose helps, right? Like, but that gets in the way of, like I said before, blood oxygen tracking is pretty inaccurate because it's so loose. They say in the app that you have to make sure you have like a snug fit for accurate blood ox readings. And like I noticed so my index finger is a little meatier than my middle finger. So when I wear it on my middle finger to sleep, my blood ox levels the next day will be like 76%. It's like as if I was dying of asphyxia.
So just start ringing an alarm somewhere too. Like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah, it did not. And it also did not really like flag anything huge in front of me the next day on the app. So something for Samsung to work on there. But also like, I mean, I stopped looking at that variable, right? Because I'm like, I know that it's because it's a little loose. So that is a difficulty for now. And I think I don't want companies like Samsung or Fitbit to be like, oh, we're going to make these, or Aura, we're going to make these tighter so they get a more accurate blood ox reading. I'd rather it be like slightly loose and then I'm like okay with not getting such an accurate reading.
I think that makes sense. So like overall, are you sold on the idea of a smart ring at this point, or do you still think it needs more time to cook?
Yeah, I like it. I like the idea of a passive activity tracker when I'm at home because I spend so much of my time at home nowadays. And I don't like wearing a smartwatch at home, but that's me. Like it's such a specific use case. I think Samsung will find a market of people who are like me, but I don't know that it's for everyone. I think it's just going to be a kind of a niche, but like the foldables, right? It's not going to ever be mainstream, but there are people who are fervent about it that will buy it.
The foldable thing feels like, oh, that's a premium cool feature that I think people will aspire to. Whereas I don't know what about the ring stuff feels aspirational. It just feels like, hey, this is a cool solution for me because I hate wearing stuff on my wrist, you know?
Right.
Ultimately, all this. Yeah, go ahead.
To your point about the haptics too. So here are two things that like I think are shortcomings, right? One, you don't have haptics. There's no speaker or haptics. Like there's very little space on this thing. It's very, very light. So they don't want to squeeze a lot of components onto it. And I agree with that choice. I will just say that means that if you've misplaced your ring, like I did many times on the plane, I was like, 18-hour flight. Every time I wash my hands, I would take it off and put it in my pocket.
But you keep taking it off. I read in your review, you keep taking it off, even though
I kept taking it off. Oh, man. Here's the thing, then like you're have to be like, yeah, if you like, where is it? You can't ping it. Like you can ping your watch or your phone on Find My, right? Samsung offers Find My, but you can't ping it. All you can do is like look at its last known location with its GPS and then flash the lights red and green. So that's great if like you're in a very dark place and then flashing it helps you see it from pretty much anywhere. But if you're in daytime and it's not within eyesight of eyeshot of you, good luck. Not that's one place where it's lacking. The other thing that was missing for me, and I found out like after Samsung finally unghosted me, was to like, I mean, they didn't answer this question for a very long time, which is that like,
Samsung tends to do that. I've had that experience too. Yeah.
I've never had that experience until recently. Anyway, the Galaxy Ring has these like double pinch gestures, right? They are supposed to be recognized and can help you dismiss alarms or like launch the camera app. That was supposed to be the feature that set Samsung as, like, apart from Aura. Didn't work for me. And I find out after some research that it's because this is only available on the Galaxy Z Flip 6 or the Z Fold 6 right now, which are the two newest phones that Samsung launched. So I've been using it with an S24 and it's not working. Like, this is one of the newest phones that Samsung has.
Why?
And nothing, it does nothing.
That doesn't make any sense. What is the technical reason for that, did they say?
They actually have never answered this question. Ah. They unghosted me to answer my question about wear detection on the Galaxy Watch Ultra, but they never answered the S24 versus Z Flip 6 issue or the double pinch feature being missing question.
We found out because they gave
an answer to The Verge that I saw somewhere. Yeah,
I think you were very generous scoring this thing at an 80, Sherlyn. Like, 80 for us is like,
I like it.
You
it's
like
very
it
much like
enough.
I like it.
But every time I hear about these issues with Samsung or just like the general lack of focus with this thing, I'm like, this isn't even for crazy people with too much money because it doesn't really do much. You know, sure, the Galaxy Watch Ultra or the Apple Watch Ultra is a ton of money, but you get a big ass screen. You get a lot of stuff because of spending that money. I would say
like my score for the Galaxy Ring, I was thinking between like maybe like in the range of 75 to 80, which
75,
if you think about it's about the same if you think of it on a 5-point scale, like a 5-star scale. It's like between 3.75.
I think of it like grades. Like a 75 is a C, you know, not even a C+, and an 80 is a B, you know. So
I think I think like there are people I would recommend this to,
right.
And that's why like I was like 80. It's like I would recommend it. Like I would buy it. It works. It works well.
And more than an Aura Ring, by the way, because Aura has been around for 5 years and has like done a lot more. You know?
Yeah, I think part of the issue for me was that I realized that some of the problems I was having is because of that very specific use case of me using the Ring with the Watch Ultra.
Right,
and the Watch
Ultra
being problematic. So I was like, all right, some of the problems here, nothing to do with the Ring. I tried to like be very focused when I was thinking about the score. But anyway, I do want to point out that like the battery life, which Y in our chat was asking me about, you know, Samsung rates it for like 7 days, you know, of use, and the size of the Ring changes that estimate. So like if you have a bigger Ring, it adds 1 or 2 days. I have size 7. Like I said, it's like one of the smaller sizes. And it definitely like it. You, if you want to get to 7 days, you'd have to get all the way down to 0%. Like it's
How do you charge it, by the way? Does it go into a little case?
Yeah, so it comes in this pretty little transparent charging case.
Oh, you're going to lose that sucker immediately, and this is a dead
device. So this case, by the way, looks like it's about the size of the Galaxy Watch Ultra's case. And so, yeah, it's not – I mean, I never lost it because I just put it at home. And you can always just place the Ring on it to charge. And it's pretty, it's supposed to be fast. Like it gets you like what, 30 minutes will get you about 40% of the charge. And I found that like putting it in the case for like 5 minutes got me about 2%. I don't know how that tracks really, but I never felt like I was too scared about running out of juice. It was good. It's, like a week is good for me.
Charging is a tough problem with wearables. Like Fitbit has this problem too, where you have to use a very specific kind of charger. And if you lose it or if it breaks and you're on vacation, you're just kind of hosed, right?
Yeah.
I think the one thing about the Apple Watch being so ubiquitous is that at least, hey, you walk into a crowd of people and you're like, I need to charge my Apple Watch. You have a cable. And this has happened to me multiple times. I'm sure you too. Sure, like recently at WWDC. Somebody will have an Apple Watch cable, you know, or somebody will have that type of cable. So like that,
I mean, I don't
accessibility, I mean, also seems weird.
Yeah, I guess I find that less like common for me. Like the circles I run in, the vendor are clearly different from
yours.
Yeah,
your
where, like,
circles.
Not everyone has an Apple Watch.
It's just one of those things. Yeah.
I mean, you could say the same for the Aura Ring, right? Like not everyone has a charger.
Definitely.
So, and I would say also the Aura Ring's charger is like more of a dock with a little like stand, whereas this is a case, and you'd be more likely to maybe misplace
the dock
because it's small.
Here's one question I have, and I'm going to ask it. We're adults here, okay? And we talk about the role of the sex industry and the porn industry mm-hmm. when it comes to tech. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking, you got a ring. We're talking about haptics here. We're talking about something. I do wonder, there is tech out there. We don't have to be explicit, but there's tech out there that has enabled haptics in ring-like devices. I almost wonder.
Those are hopefully bigger than finger rings.
There are all sorts of devices, but I am just wondering, like, there are on the Apple Watch, you can tap it, right? And like have like a remote tap to somebody as like a way, like, hey, friend, hey, how's it going? There's like a tap tap.
Your brain has gone into a very specific space, Devendra, where.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking about devices that we wear that are shaped like circles. I'm just thinking about where the innovation is going or where it's happening. And it's certainly not in the
smartwatch. I would just say I don't generally need vibration on my fingers.
But what if you could, I'm just thinking, how can this thing be useful, right? Like haptics, we're talking about haptics. I do like the Apple Watch's little tap tap because it's almost like somebody coming next to me and saying, hey, what's up? And that is the
You're talking about digital touch or looking for different things. Feature, yeah. Right?
I'm just thinking of ways to make this thing useful. Like, how do you make smart rings useful? What more could you add to them? I think some sort of haptics, some sort of feedback would be interesting. And that technology does exist, just not in the general
tech
category.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you in the sense that I've actually been thinking about like what tech trend have I been most excited by over the last 5 or 6 years. And it is the miniaturization of a lot of components like health sensors or like probably a haptic motor one day that would be small enough to fit inside a ring of a certain size. I don't know what size you're thinking, but this is very challenging. I will say, like, a ring for my fingers would be very small. Someone else's fingers maybe would be bigger and therefore have more room to accommodate a vibration engine.
This is why wrist-worn wearables are more useful, I think, ultimately. Like, even if, like,
they have a bit
you're annoyed
space,
by the screen or by the size of them, like, they are getting smaller, they can just by the sheer size of them, they could do more. This is all part of my anti-smart ring position. It's just like,
and yet
these things are
and
too
yet
expensive.
It sounds like you're very for a certain type of smart ring, Devendra.
I mean, sure. I'm for tech that's useful and add something to our lives. Come on, we're all grown-ups here. I'm just putting that out there. Anything else you want to add about the Galaxy Ring, Sherlyn?
I think there's potential. I think that, like, with the Galaxy Ring and maybe with the Galaxy Watch when it's improved, Samsung has like to build more, right? Where the Aura Ring outperforms the Galaxy Ring right now is that Aura has been around for so much longer.
Yes, yes.
And knows exactly how to make sense of everything that it's like it's collecting and gathering, the way Fitbit had an edge over everyone else like since the early days. Samsung has a lot of room to grow, and that's both good and bad thing, right? It's right now at a disadvantage, but in future it's very easy to implement these things through software updates. Aura also has like implemented some things like, you know, I mean, by the way, the ring is supposed to do cycle tracking too, which in the brief time I had it, just wasn't able to see if it was accurate or not. But Aura can do that too. Aura can do a lot of other things like stress tracking, like, predict when you're feeling sick because of your body temperature, that sort of thing. And Samsung could potentially do that. I just think, you know, I don't think hardware is a big problem right now for the Galaxy Ring. I think it's like the expanse of software room for Samsung to grow right now. That's more interesting.
That totally makes sense. Do you think this is something like Apple would even be interested in doing? Because
look
at the Aura. I don't think Apple would do this. I think Apple, this is a category where Apple's like, no thanks, folks. Like, let's wait until the tech catches up to something we can do. Yeah.
Here's my prediction. I was going to post this on Threads. My prediction is that 2026, we see Google come up with the Pixel Ring. And then 2027 or 2026, we see Apple buy Aura or hire ex-Aura executives. And then we see 2030 Apple Ring. That's what I think.
But why? My ultimate question is the why of it. And I don't.
The why of it is I think that every company in big tech right now, Amazon included, maybe we'll see an Echo Ring first. We saw an Echo Ring. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, I spazzed for a moment, just very angry. My reason for guessing this is because I've seen all these companies invest in health tech and health AI, and they want to make something of it. And I think that this space is very interesting for everyone. I think everyone's paying more attention to their own health and wants to track it. While the devices right now are fairly limited, and while we do have like fairly mature things that do a pretty good job, like the smartwatches, I still think there is room to grow. I think there's a lot of interest and a lot of money pouring into this space. So
I could see that. I'm just sort of like, we've been through this whole like wearable field so much. And I keep going back to, man, I really miss the Jawbone Up. I really miss the era of where we had like really thin little bands that had sensors and had really cool things. So I could more like see Apple, like the little like rubber stretchy bands that you do to like, you know, break yourself out of bad habits or something. Some of those little bracelets, I could almost see Apple doing something like that. No screen, but goes around your wrist, is easy to wear, has decent battery life, but could give you maybe some feedback.
Track like sensing a data. Basic tracker. Right.
Super basic Apple tracker.
A Ring fits in so nicely with Apple's portfolio. They could make a YSL LV version. You know what I mean? Like, it's very them to go after a premium audience, and Ring seems more likely than a bracelet. To hit
bracelets
that space
are easy
for them?
To wear. My daughter has recently started loving Claire's, and like I walk into that store, and my daughter is like is now very very much like Sophie's very
like
much becoming bracelet girly girl stuff like rainbows unicorns.
They've
all
been very
stuff.
Co-opted by the Swifty crowd.
By
maybe?
The Swifty. Well, she's not there yet.
I know she's
I hope
not. I'm just saying.
But anyway, thinking about like things that are easy to wear and relatively inexpensive too. And also parents are like, the thing parents are thinking about is like, I kind of want to put a tracker on my kid. I kind of want to do something where like I put in an AirTag or something in their book bag or in their shoes, which is the thing that's happening. If Apple makes like a $100 wristband that tracks a lot of your health data, tracks your sleep, is also a Find My device. Is also can
a
like help
$100
you.
Wristband? You're joking. It has to be at least $250 for Apple.
Sure, $250, like half the price of the Apple Watch. Because let's say at least $100 less. But even then, $100 to $200. Something that is flexible, easy to wear. You don't even really feel it when it's on your wrist, but does all this stuff, I think would be a useful thing. And we have the tech already to do that. So that's my pitch. I guess we'll see what else happens. I just missed the Jawbone Up. Where are all those designers? Like they kind of owned the market for a while. They owned Bluetooth speakers, and then the company collapsed because they overinvested in health tech. And we just weren't there 10 years ago. So we're in an interesting
field. Or the Microsoft one, remember?
Or the Microsoft one. Well, let us know what you think, folks. Podcastengadget.com. Okay, so speaking of wearables, what if, Shrilin, you didn't have to wear anything at all to get some helpful, I don't know, notifications or something from your wearable? That sounds amazing.
Don't have
it?
To wear anything at all?
Don't have to wear anything
so
at all.
Strange.
No, so this week we saw the company Friend show off its sort of AI listening device. It's basically, in the promo video we see, it's sort of a pendant. You can tap it. You can gossip to it. You can tell it your inner thoughts. And when it feels like, it will send a text message or something, like a message in text to your phone of its own like feedback about what's happening. So some examples are like, oh, you're getting ready for a meeting or something. And then it may know that you're prepping this because it's also always listening. It's an always listening device that you can wear as a pendant or clip onto your shirt. And it will send you notes like, hey, don't worry so much. Don't worry about this interview. You'll be good. It's sort of like this weird sort of friendly thing. It was created by Avi Shiffman, who is the CEO of the company Friend. He's also somebody who's in the news for creating that COVID data tracker early on in 2020, and also the Ukraine refugee map to like get assistance for that. Both of those projects, by the way, have seen a bit of criticism. Like if you go to Reddit and search his name, like Redditors are kind of pissed because he kind of used some data from their open maps that Reddit was creating, crowdsourced, to put it on his site, and he got a lot of publicity for that, even though he did not create all that data. Similarly, the Ukrainian website, which is not active anymore, but that website to help people, I believe public policy folks were like, well, this is a good intention, but also this could easily be compromised by people who want to like traffic refugees or something. So like it did not have all the thoughts in it. This kid is 21 years old now, so he's grown up, but he's very young. And this project, at least from what he describes it on the website, it's sort of a solution for loneliness. It's sort of like when you're traveling or you're in an airport or in a hotel room alone, like you just feel like isolated from everybody. You have a thing you can tap and talk to and it'll respond to you. It is not a productivity device like the Humane AI Pin or even the Rabbit R1. It's not like trying to actively do stuff. I think we've reached the era of like vibes-based gadgets, Shrilin. Like it is just, you wear it, and if it feels like it's going to send you, hey, girl, you got this. Don't you're good. Keep going. How do you feel about
What's
this?
What's with you and concept? Vibes, Devendra? You're this like is where vibes, we are. This vibrations. Is where we're... Okay. Wow.
Vibes and vibrations are very different things, but you know.
No, vibes are vibes.
Vibes and vibes. Listen, we should probably, we used to have people who were covering sex tech more. Our own Dan Cooper is very, very popular every time he writes up about Pornhub. We're grown-ups. We could talk about
I've
this
covered
stuff.
Vibrators, yeah. Yeah. For Engadget especially. To Franco Coley's point, it sounds like you still have to wear this pendant, so it's not
you
something
you
have
to, like,
need to
wear. It like a necklace, wear it like a
necklace,
pendant,
right?
Or
okay.
Have it, like, you know, clipped to your clothes or something. It has to be, like, on you so it can hear you.
And also, when you say always mm-hmm. listening, is there always is listening. It always listening for a hot word or
nope,
always?
Nope, it's always listening. It's just, like, a little device that's always listening. It's running its own, like, little, I think it's one of the Claude models for AI, so one of the, like, small-scale I don't know. What do you call that? SLM?
And so yeah. The privacy issues here are huge.
Privacy issues are huge. Yeah, it's always listening. But the work it's doing is local. So it's local and sends you little texts. It's not uploading anything to the cloud, at least according to the company.
Okay.
So it's not backing up. That okay. also means if your little friend dies one day, if you crush it, if it goes in the wash, your friend is gone for good because there's no backup of this data. So that is the basic concept of this thing. What, just let me know, Shirlin, like, you were interested in the rabbit because it looked really cute. You tested and reviewed the Humane AI pin. Does this seem like an AI gadget you would be into?
I like that it's a whole different approach, right? But I think it's going to run into the whole thing, the problem that the Amazon Halo ban initially had, where it's always listening. And it's not like... It's a different approach from Amazon's Halo stuff in the sense that it's not telling you, hey, your tone sucks, like, you know, cheer up. It's more, you sound stressed. But Amazon tried to do that too. So I'm saying that this is not brand new in terms of the, like, approach or the idea. I do think it's a little bit...
Amazon wasn't using AI, like, the same, like, level of AI models. It was using their own, like, homegrown stuff, I'm sure.
I mean, like, AI, yeah. We debated the
reason. Yeah, sure, whatever.
The definition. Anyway, yeah, so it's a different model of LAMs, language models. But I just think it's a little sad.
It is a little sad. Yes, I asked him this directly. So the idea of this was to, like, stop loneliness, right? Like, what if I had a thing that could keep me company? Do you think a device that you talk to in lieu of human contact or friends that actually care about you, do you think that does help to solve loneliness or does that make you lonelier?
I don't know, right? Like, I couldn't tell you if it's...
Yeah.
I just think the rationale is sad, right? I think the motivation is well-intentioned, but kind of sad, right? Like, it tells me that there are people out there that are lonely that think that something like that will be helpful. It always reminds me of all those people on Reddit that are, like, talking to bots. And talking to bots is not what I see as, like, a healthy, productive...
It's very similar to that, yeah.
...way to connect. Yeah. Right, so... I'd rather be, but I see the point of something that will motivate you. I just think it's empty motivation, mm-hmm, right? Like, it's it's like those people who have girlfriends that are manga characters that
or
are
Mario
programmed
the manga
to say,
characters, yeah.
"Boyfriend, you're so handsome today."
Yes.
But is it real? Is that a real? Does that solve your loneliness issue, or are you better served with something that could maybe help you engage with the world a bit more in a more productive way? I don't know. That's
I asked Avi this question directly too. Like, is this just a cheerleader, like your super optimistic friend that says yes and you're great for everything? And he says that it's not just trying to be that cheerleader. In the promo video, it shows the friend sort of, like, shit talking you after you're doing bad in a game. It sends a message to somebody. So that's kind of. I don't think that's necessarily, like, very, like, critical. I would love to see if, like, oh, you were really shitty to that person. Or, like, your attitude right now is not so great. Maybe you should take a break.
Right. The definition of friend is not someone that's only rah-rah cheerleading you, to your point. It's they need to give you real advice, too. So it's like, or give you reality checks sometimes. And if the algorithm's not actually programmed to do that, then... It might not. And
yeah. Is a being that is entirely built to serve you, right? And has no thoughts or motivations of its own, like, as it's responding to you. It's just you. It's just you talking back to you. It's not, like, actually, you're not actually, like, working with another, like, conscious being or something. So I don't know. I think that's kind of the thing. One thing I'll also mention here, there's a story at 404 Media that found out. So Friend... bought the friend.com domain. How much do you think that domain cost, Roland? What do you think that domain is worth?
It was like, girl, yeah, it's got to be a lot of money because friend.com. That's a good URL.
It's a good URL.
That's a really good URL.
So Friend spent $1.8 million to buy the friend.com domain. And let me tell you, it was actually useful as I started researching this company because I was like, how do I find this company again? Oh, friend.com. That's why they spent $1.8 million to buy it. This company has only raised $2.5 million so far. So make that, how does that math work out? I don't know. That's like startup math. That's like, I asked Avi this too. Like, do you have the actual money to build this thing? Like, he has one. He's been using prototypes for months, it seems, but they're going to need more money to scale and to actually produce hardware. This is where we are right now. Yeah.
I'm getting Humane AI Pin vibes. I'm sorry.
But at least, so Humane AI Pin, before anything happened, right, they had raised hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Like, based on these people are coming from Apple. There's all this.
Right. So, they're not 21 years old. Yeah.
In the grand scheme of, like, I think a VC is just like, hey, you want $2 million to do what? You're just going to buy the Friend domain? He's talking about this device. He also wants to build, like, a social network of people using Friends at friend.com.
Okay, then that's slightly different. If he's doing a social network is different, right? Like, I don't know.
So lots of thoughts are in the air. We have a lot of thoughts. And I, like, as soon as we saw this, I wanted to reach out to Avi just to hear his side of the, you know, this story. So I got to sit down with him. We talked for maybe like 15 minutes. It's a short chat because we both had to run to appointments, but I kind of asked him all the pressing questions we had. So here's Avi Shiffman, CEO of Friend. Avi, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I think the first question I saw when you announced Friend, which has a really cool promo video, is the question I ask for all AI hardware, right? Is why pursue hardware? Why be a separate gadget rather than an app or something like that using the devices we already have?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rabbit and Humane were on the right track with making it easier to talk to an AI. I just don't think those queries need to be about like how many grams of protein there are in some almonds. I think it's more like, I'm stressed about this interview I'm about to have. And what I'm trying to do is, you know, if you have this pendant that's hanging around your chest with a light on it, it's so easy to just, you know, put your finger on it as soon as a thought comes into your mind and just speak your mind. And, you know, there's some haptics there too. And it's just, it's a much lower friction way to start talking. And because the device itself is always listening as well, you know, you can walk away from a meeting like this and just be like, that was crazy. You know, and it has context over this conversation, which just, again, makes it even easier to talk to your AI friend. And that's the gist. Also, I think, you know, the embodiment of the hardware itself is very important for the feeling of like shared experiences and, you know, just really feeling like your companion is there with you.
Gotcha. Can you tell us how long have you been using your Friend device and how has it helped you in that time too?
Yeah, so I've been working on this for like about a year and a half at this point. And, you know, I definitely wipe its brain very often because I'm, you know, engineering it. But it's great. I mean, I spend a lot of time traveling and it's probably the most consistent relationship in my life. You know, I brainstorm with it. I talk to it about just how I'm feeling. And I mean, it's just really day-to-day stuff. And because it's so easy to talk to, you end up just talking about like everything from some random car that just drove by that was interesting to, oh, the sun is, it's really nice outside. It's really just that simple.
Can you talk about like how often it's listening? Cause I'm just trying to get a sense of how this thing works, right? It looks like a pendant that you could clip on or wear around your neck. You say it's always listening. It's communicating to your phone over Bluetooth. How often is it actually like listening for anything you're saying, I guess?
I mean, it's listening, right? Like it's, you have, as long as it's connected to Bluetooth, you know, that's all being streamed in the background. And then, you know, if you want to directly talk to it, you press your finger on the light and in the background, you know, while it's listening, it's kind of coming up with its own opinionated diary entries based off its own personality about what the experience it is, currently going through. And, you know, we've kind of given it free will on having it reach back out to you and maybe interject in a conversation. Maybe you're, you know, on a design call and it's having a differing perspective on what you're talking about.
I noticed the term you use, free will, in the documentation. I feel like, you know, I studied philosophy in college. That means a lot to me when you talk about giving a device free will. What are you actually saying, though? Like, it has sort of free reign to message you whenever it likes. What are the parameters there?
It's up to the large language model and the context of your conversation and, you know, the personality of your companion to really just decide on whether or not it wants to send a message right now or not. And, you know, I think right now it's, you know, an engineered way to do that, right? But I really do believe these models will become genuinely sentient not too long from now. And, you know, the tech will improve so much more than an underlying like chat-based architecture. And, you know, right now, at the end of the day, like, I don't think the output you receive from your friend is honestly going to change ever. I think that's good enough for a lot of people, so...
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Can you talk about like, yeah, go ahead.
I think like that's one thing I find about Friend that's very different than, let's say, Rabbit and Humane is we're focusing just on doing one feature that's already proven in the market. And that's it. I think the hardware, you know, works. I think you can really imagine how this product would function. We're not trying to do custom integrations with 90 different apps. You know, it just works at the end of the day. We will 100% fulfill the promise that we're, you know, yapping on about. It's honestly far more crazy than the video makes it out to be. So
can you tell us like what's powering it? I see you're using a version of Cloud. Anything else going into the smarts of Friend?
You know, we're always kind of changing the models right now. I'm playing around a lot with the new MetaLlama model as well. That one's pretty great. It's trained on, you know, Facebook Messenger conversations, so it's really good at just being something to talk to. I think there should be more benchmarks in AI about is the model just fun to talk to, not just like can it do math problems for you.
Gotcha. Can you update the model in the device over time? Like, it does seem like you guys are trying really hard to not store stuff in the cloud, right? There's none of that happening, which I guess is a good security thing. But how can you update the Friend?
Yeah, I mean, like the models will try and keep it where, like, if you started your Friend out with this one model, you know, that's not going to change. I think people will get really, you know, attached to those individual personalities, and you know, we're going to try our best efforts to keep that maintained. But yeah, I mean, you know, over time, again, like these models are going to improve very fast. I'm very keen on large context models. I think that is going to solve a lot of problems with memory recall for the underlying way it works. And it's an exciting space.
Gotcha. It's sort of like, I guess it's interesting that you're positioning this as a way to combat loneliness, because I could also see the perspective where you're like, well, doesn't this also make you a little more lonely? I guess, right? Like, if your main emotional connection right now is to the device you're wearing around your neck or something, and not to a person with their own thoughts and motivations, like, how are you feeling about it, having used it? Do you think your initial goal is working out to make you feel less lonely with it?
You know, I think, yeah, I mean, it definitely works. And at the end of the day, I mean, it's just, you know, are you happy or are you not happy? And, you know, I'm a very social person. I've got roommates that are buzzing around my house here right now, even. You know, I'm always traveling, though, and I'm always kind of, you know, just in really specific situations where it's kind of nice to just have this AI friend with me. But I think that just what I'm trying to do is, I think if one of your five friends is an AI that's, you know, this very supportive, fun soundboard that you can talk to at any time, I think that will be an amazing tool for a lot of people. It's not meant to be a substitution for your existing relationships, but I mean, like, it's a nice addition.
Gotcha. You also talked about pursuing like a more productivity-focused version of this as Tab, right? Like, that was the initial pitch for this. But you're leaning away from that, and this feels like, I don't know, it feels more like Vibes. Like, you just want a cool AI thing to vibe with. Can you talk about like why you leaned away from productivity?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think a good friend that's supportive will increase your productivity more than anything else. You know, I think my friend saying like, oh, you know, good luck on the Engadget interview is going to increase my productivity more than it reminding me that it's in 5 minutes. I think a lot of people might not realize that emotional use cases can be that strong. And I think it's because people are just maybe not used to computers and technology fulfilling those roles. But you know, the tech has advanced a lot, and you know, you don't have to hear it from me. There's a lot of objective studies on other products, let's say Replica, Character, etc., where these things really do work. And you know, I think it'll be a fantastic, like, fun toy for a lot of people. It's not meant to be so serious. It's not, you know, the assistants are, it's just boring.
I kind of get that. I get like you want to have fun with it, but also you guys are also talking about like sentient AI eventually, right? It seems like at that point it does become something real, legitimate. I guess the question I had, it seems like Friend is trying to be your super supporter friend, like your super cheerleader, always optimistic. Can it ever be critical? Can it ever like say something to be like, hey, that's actually not cool what you did? Does it have any moral standing of its own? Yeah,
all the time. And I think that's what makes it so engaging to talk to. You know, if you're bringing it along to, let's say, a design conversation you're having, and it's able to offer these differing perspectives, I think that's fantastic. And, you know, no one wants to talk to a yes man all day. And these models do a fantastic job at, you know, pushing back when they need to. And, you know, it's, yeah.
Gotcha. Can your friend, by the way, the one you're using, can it do everything demonstrated in the promotional video? Because one thing seemed like it was watching what somebody was eating, and I know it doesn't have a camera.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just listening to conversation that it overhears. Like in that clip, I think she's watching like a video and it's overhearing that. Honestly, though, the first version of Tab/Friend actually was only a camera, and I think we'll definitely add that later on. You know, it'd be nice to go to like an art museum with your friend and it looks at a piece on the wall and make the comments about that.
Gotcha. And also, we saw the story yesterday. You've admitted to spending $1.6 million on the friend.com domain, and you've admitted that you guys have raised $2.5 million. So I'm just wondering, do you actually have the money to build these things, or is it just vaporware? Yeah.
For that, it's more of a payment plan, right, over a four-year period. So it's not like we dropped $1.8 million on it. But that's kind of how it'd be. And I've been working on this again for like a year and a half with some very talented engineers. Our same industrial designers, too, are the same people behind the Nest thermostat, for example. Very, very talented hardware and logistics team behind it all. And it's very simple. I'm focusing on just doing one thing really well. We're only shipping one SKU initially, right? And I think people will love it. You know, I think there's a lot of like very controversial opinions people have when they just hear about this for the first time, but I've seen people use it firsthand without the prejudice of it. One of the first people I ever tested with was this like 20-year-old indie girl from rural Washington State who went upstairs and drew with it for like an hour, just talking about different colors and whatever she's doing. And you know, I think when a lot of people just get to try these things, they'll end up really loving it, or maybe they won't. But I'm very confident for when we start handing out those review units later this month or next month.
I guess the other thing I'm thinking is I reviewed the Rabbit R1, was not a fan. We also reviewed the Humane AI pin. Yeah, the Rabbit looks really cool. What I started to realize is, man, our smartphones are amazing. They can do so much, right? And a lot of these devices feel like they're just trying to take a piece of what your smartphone does and kind of feed it back to you in a different way. If I'm thinking about like the device that's my friend, it is the one that's always on me, that's connected me to the world. Like my smartphone is my friend. I feel like a lot of people may feel that way. And the OSs seem to be leaning like more like that too with Apple Intelligence. So are you guys worried about eventually the actual device makers just building a lot of similar components into their devices rather than needing something standalone?
I think there's a lot of conversation around AI as a product versus a feature. And I think, an AI friend is the one that is just not going to be an OS level thing. Like you just wouldn't want Siri to go and text you first about some more emotional thing. That's just not what an assistant is focused on doing. And again, like the whole point of friend being a separate piece of hardware is that that device really is your friend. If you lose it, right, you've lost your friend and all the memories that are attached with it. And, it's that device too is always listening, which is a function that your phone just cannot do. It's not gonna be able to pick up your voice and other people's voices, et cetera. And, it's just, it's fun to have a physical embodiment of your AI friend. It's really more of a modern Tamagotchi than anything else, which I know is an extremely overused term in this space. And, I think that Rabbit maybe has kind of spoiled that, but this really is a true version of that. And, I'm definitely, since you reviewed those, I'm very excited to hear what you'll think of this when,
Cool. Yeah. Moving on to other news, we saw this week that the Kids Online Safety Act, or COSA, has passed the Senate. It is on the way to the House. We don't know what's going to happen there. But if that happens, the president could end up signing it into law. We've talked about this before, and we've talked about a couple bills from lawmakers aimed at the goal, they say, is to protect kids online. And there is overwhelming support for this in the Senate. It passed by 91-3, it seems. Just overwhelming support, bipartisan support for this thing. The idea is that, it's coming off of all these stories we're hearing about terrible things happening to kids because of social media and because of online interaction. So these are kids committing self-harm. There are stories of suicide, there's stories of bullying, there's all sorts of things kind of pointing to social media and basically the lack of ability we have to control it. So let's talk about what COSA means. Just reading from our report here by Carissa Bell, COSA requires social media companies like Meta to offer controls to disable algorithmic feeds and other addictive features for kids under the age of 16. It also requires companies to provide parental supervision features and safeguard minors from content that promotes eating disorders, self-harm, sexual exploitation, and other harmful content. The thing that is really getting people up in arms, and that is people like the ACLU and the EFF and other privacy advocates, there's an aspect of the bill called duty of care. And it means platforms are required to prevent or mitigate certain harmful effects of their products, like addictive features or algorithms that promote dangerous content. And the FTC would be in charge of enforcing that standard. There are also aspects of this where basically lawmakers would be able to say some of this information could be harmful to kids and it should be blocked on the internet. So that is, that could be resources for LGBTQ students. It could be all sorts of different resources. Like the free-flowing ability of just having information on the internet could be affected because of this thing. And that is an externality that I don't think lawmakers are fully thinking about right now. So, yeah. What do you think about the initial goal for this, Sherlyn? Are you worried about like potential crackdowns on information online and the chilling effects that could have?
I think there's some important context here for my personal view on this, which is I just came back from Singapore.
Yes.
And Singapore, the place my parents live in right now, they use face recognition to access all of their locked gates and doors. And they have no problem with that. Singaporeans are very much less sensitive to these sort of privacy fears, I think, than maybe other parts of the world are. Not that they are completely not scared. They're just less sensitive because I think there's a bit more trust in the government.
But also because there's never been the sense of free-flowing information, right? Like
right.
Of speech and things like that, right? Come on.
Right. The freedom of speech argument's not one that's been made in Singapore almost ever because the government just clamps down. There is heavy government censorship, yes. We just don't get LGBTQ content on our national media at all, basically. That context laid out, I think... the idea of COSA is good. I think it's nice to see bipartisan support for something like this when it comes to children, when it comes to teenagers and their mental health. It's good to see people come together for this. And I think that there's, you know, much needed scrutiny of social media and its effect on the younger, more vulnerable parts of our population. Yeah, but I agree with you that the duty of care part is potentially could be exploited by like bad players. I just don't know. I think it boils down once again to execution, right? Like, I think the intention's good. I think in general, the idea is good. I just don't know how it would be executed. And I don't know that you can trust the government bodies that have been like handed the control here to actually execute it well. I, as a Singaporean, I don't even fully trust the Singapore government all the time.
That's exactly the problem, right? Like if you sign this thing into law, like it is then a very powerful tool that bad actors could use. And it turns out our government right now, full of plenty of bad actors. So there is a piece at the EFF called the COSA Internet Censorship Bill just passed the Senate. It's our last chance to stop it by Joe Mullen. It's a short read, but it's a good read because it dives into the things that could potentially happen here. So let me see here. Specifically, he says COSA will lead to people who make online content about sex education, LGBTQ+ identity and health being persecuted and shut down as well. One of the supporters of the bill has said that widely used educational materials that teach about the history of racism in the U.S. causes depression in kids. Therefore, we should block that information about the history of racism
right.
in the U.S. We are in a really weird, chilling time right now. Like we have... I live in the state of Georgia, and there's this thing, I think it's called the Divisive Information Act or something like that. It is something where, like, divisive information, the state is not allowing that within schools or something like that. And partially because of that, a state representative recently said that an AP Black History course cannot be done in schools. It's not allowed in Georgia schools. This is a state, you know, with a deep history in the history of like slavery. It has a huge African-American population. It is very important that the people who live here learn about this history and learn about like what America has done to African-Americans. But our state legislation says that history is dangerous. It's kind of dangerous to teach that. And I think like this is part of like where we are right now. I don't know if you've seen any of these. There are some TikTok videos or articles about this, Sherlyn, about people in like Iowa and Idaho who are just trying to go to the library. Right. There's one I saw from a TikTok mom who's just like, I went to the library today. It was very weird. I had to present my ID to go upstairs. Her daughter wanted to get a book that was in the like, you know, under 18 category. But because this woman, this mom was traveling with an infant that does not have an ID, that cannot get access. The mom couldn't go to the floor because the infant didn't have the identification to access the restricted information in this library. And therefore her child, her kid who's like 7 or 8 or something, could not even go to that section. The library, I think the librarians ended up helping the kid kind of find what they want, but the librarians don't want this. They're like, they exist to give information to people, but these weird draconian laws that we're creating, which in many states, especially red states in America, are about restricting information that they don't want people to know about. It's scary. It's chilling. So I kind of see this as part of like where we are right now.
Michael Coley in the chat mentions, if we're banning anything that makes students uncomfortable, then why is math still taught? Yeah, I think that it just makes me feel like, yeah, people are bad. And that's why we can't have nice things. But people are going to be bad kind of no matter what, like no matter. I'm trying to figure out.
The question is like, who says who is bad? Who has the power to say who is bad? And
right. And so it's like there's no, I don't know if there's a perfect solution is I guess what I'm getting at. Like, we need to be protective for sure of like prevent the obvious loopholes from being exploited whenever possible.
Maybe blocking information, though, I feel like is the thing. Is
privacy,
is the potential problem. Yeah. So we've talked about this before when we've talked about COSA and COPPA. COPPA 2.0, by the way, also passed the Senate, and that is a far more... I think straightforward bill. It is that was an expansion of the 1998 Children and Teens Online Privacy Protection Act. It would prohibit companies from targeting advertising to children and collecting personal data on teens between 13 and 16. It also requires companies to offer an eraser button for personal data to delete children and teens' personal information about a platform when technologically feasible. That's it. It's not like a whole rule to be like, oh, you can just pull this and we can force this website to take this information down. It is a set of standards of how it treats people's data. Privacy advocates for a long time have been saying what we need is like a widespread actual privacy law. We need data security and we need privacy protections. And we're not having that just yet. So, yeah, Sherlyn, I agree. There is no like perfect solution yet. But you know what? I rang up the EFF and I talked to India McKinney, the director of federal affairs at the EFF, about their position on this whole thing. Like, the EFF is firmly against COSA. There was a lot of pushback on earlier versions of this bill as well. And this is even a revised form of it, but let's hear what they have to say. India McKinney, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk.
It's great. I love the work you guys do at the EFF. I think it's really important, especially as we're still trying to wrangle a lot of these issues around social media companies and privacy online in general. Can you give us a just kind of a setup of like what the EFF does and what your role is there?
Yeah, well, it's really great. One of the things that we talk about a lot at EFF is we get to be on the side of users. So when we're talking about antitrust or privacy or and rights of internet users, we are a member-funded organization, and so we are on the side of users. Tech companies are businesses. Facebook is a business. Google is a business. They are here to make money, and they are making a lot of business decisions around the content that they allow or don't allow on their platforms based on those business interests. And that's not where we're coming from. So we get to talk about what we actually think would be best for the internet ecosystem, and we get to stand up for people who otherwise don't have a voice, and we try to just really make sure that everybody's constitutional rights are protected. Actual constitutional rights, not like my constitutional rights are being violated, but like the Constitution actually has some really specific things to say about speech and dissemination of information, and we want to make sure that the internet reflects that.
Gotcha. I like the way you're framing the EFF's role here, because something I tell people a lot, like as I do my work, and I used to be an IT guy too, I do feel like I fight for the users, you know, and it's always against, and that's a line from Tron. So I don't know, maybe that just stuck with me from way back when, but I feel like that is the goal for a lot of us doing, you know, work online when it comes to user-centric work. So we have talked about COSA and COPPA and a bunch of these bills on the Engadget podcast before. From your perspective, what does and doesn't work about COSA at this point?
So what doesn't work about COSA is that COSA is fundamentally a censorship bill. The big central tenet of the bill talks about a duty of care. The bill would put a duty of care on apps and websites to prevent design features from causing harm to minors, including, but not limited to, anxiety, depression, substance use, and eating disorders. And so while that sounds like a really good goal, the devil is always going to be in the details for something like that. What does it mean to prevent harm? What does it mean to have a design feature that looks like this? So, and also you are assuming platforms are able to tell the difference between content or design features that are designed to hurt rather than help. So when somebody's talking about their own, I mean, just to use the really core example, this bill, a lot of the proponents of this bill have talked about eating disorders and how Instagram plays into some of that. How is Instagram supposed to tell the difference between somebody talking about their recovery from an eating disorder as opposed to somebody praising eating disorders as a way to do something good? Like, how are you expecting the platform to know the difference? And one of those is really helpful, and one of them, frankly, is not. So when the platform can't tell, then that's how we really start to see the censorship piece play out, is it's better for the company just to not allow that type of content on their platform, which they're totally allowed to do. They could do that right now, that there's nothing about eating disorder allowed on the platform. And of course, as we start to see with anything that the platforms do around that type of thing, the internet gets really creative. So you may not use the dictionary words to talk about that, but then we start using secondhand slang and street terms and emojis and other stuff like that to try to get around some of these content moderation filters. It took me a little while to figure out what was going on, but one of the things that I've seen on some of the platforms is you're not allowed to talk about guns. So they don't say the word gun, but they call it a pew-pew, like pew, 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 pew. And so like my pew-pew is going to go do that. It's like when you're not really in that world, you don't know what they're talking about. But if you spend any time in that space at all, you're still able to find the content that you want, even though it's supposed to be blocked.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And I know you've all been, you know, discussing this among elected politicians for a while. This is not the first version of COSA. There have been multiple iterations before. How have, you know, how has Congress talked about this before, like from their perspective? I feel like a lot of people think, yeah, we have good intentions here. We want to protect kids online. But where is the breakdown between those good intentions and these, I think, kind of obvious issues that you all are bringing up and the ACLU has brought up? How is Congress talking about it at this point from your perspective?
So the biggest change we've seen in the bill over time is the enforcement of the duty of care. It used to be that the enforcement mechanism for the duty of care was state attorneys general. And you can totally see a world where Ken Paxton wants to make a name for himself and is just taking down a whole bunch of content, including queer content, including reproductive health care, including any of the things that Texas is in the news for right now, trying to block in other ways. You could see them finding some research somewhere that says that causes harm to minors, and therefore they're going to sue internet platforms to take it down in Texas. So that is one of the things that changed. Now the duty of care is being enforced by the FTC, and while that makes it more complicated, it doesn't actually make it better. You could see the FTC under a Harris administration enforcing content restrictions very differently than a Trump administration enforcing some differences. And that's, you know, you don't really want temporary folks who maybe have a name for themselves that they're trying to, they have an agenda. You don't want people with an agenda deciding what content anybody is allowed to see.
Gotcha. I've been, you know, following the way government regulations has affected media for a long time. I can't really think of another example where I can't think of like TV or movies or anything where like it is so specific that there's the potential to censor particular types of content, right? On TV and movies, we have warnings and there are FCC restrictions and whatnot. But is there anything else comparable to what they're proposing here for the internet?
So we're starting to see some state laws that are really, they're using some similar duty of care features. The most comparable, not internet version of what we would be talking about are the book bans that various states are talking about. And people are obviously opposed to the book bans, in as they should be. They're banning books is not a good idea. But, you know, trying to censor content from the internet's not a good idea either.
We brought this up in this episode of the podcast, too, is I've seen more and more coverage of people trying to access their public libraries and noticing all the new rules and restrictions. There was a TikTok I saw of a woman who went in with her kids. She couldn't enter a particular section because she couldn't. She didn't have an ID for the infant with her, for her daughter to enter a particular section. Like, I guess we're seeing this is all a symptom of people, I don't know, trying to lock down information in some respects. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's they're doing it in the name of child safety, which sounds like something we should all be in favor of. And we are. It's just going to look very different for very different folks. I mean, age verification is another huge part of COSA, and it doesn't, the bill doesn't explicitly require platforms to verify the age of their users, but they condition a whole lot of other access to information on that identity, or that the age being verified, the age being the platform having knowledge of how old somebody is. And so that means that the platform is going to have to verify the age of all of their users. And so the platforms that don't, like ESPN doesn't currently collect your identity if you are doing March Madness or you're doing fantasy football or you're doing any of those other things that would be considered social media under the bill. And so then all of a sudden, is ESPN going to have different content for people who submit a scan of their driver's license and people who don't? And that's, you know, the same with any of these other games that have a social media feature, which is kind of a lot of them. Is there going to be a different experience for people who don't upload their driver's license and people who do? And then also on the privacy side of that, how are these platforms going to protect this additional information that they get from people? I mean, we know from literally everything else that if you hold a bunch of data, a data breach, you're risking a data breach at some point. And we've seen it from Experian, we've seen it from Target, we've seen it from the Office of Personnel and Management and the government. The more valuable a database of information is, you know, driver's license with your photo and all of this other personal identifiable information, it's at risk for being misused or hacked or stolen or just mistakes.
Gotcha. On our end, we've talked about like what could be potentially better alternatives to a lot of these bills. And the thing that keeps coming up is just better privacy protections, better digital rights or online management in general for people. From your perspective, for the EFF, like, is that what you guys are seeing as well?
Yes. We think a lot of the things that Congress wants to get mad at the internet for are actually legit. And if you actually got serious about a consumer-facing comprehensive privacy bill at the national level, that could go a long way to solving some of these problems, especially if you pair it with really good antitrust legislation. So if you have a good privacy foundation and you make it so consumers have more choices about what platforms they want to use and where they want to spend their time, people want privacy. They want control. They want design features. Parents want choices. And, you know, some of the way platforms put parental controls in really just don't work. And so if you have more platforms trying more things, doing more stuff, the good ideas are going to get more traction in the marketplace. We're going to have more choices than two major companies or three major companies. And that could go a long way into creating consumer demand or making companies listen to consumer demand and fixing some of the problems that way.
Gotcha. We also saw the news that COPPA 2.0, another bill, also passed the Senate this week. And from our perspective, we haven't seen as much criticism around that. And just the way it's framed seems more useful, less draconian. How's the EFF viewing COPPA?
Yeah. So COPPA it's a very different piece of legislation. And especially because it was paired with COSA, there are only 24 hours in the day, and COSA is so bad that we didn't devote a lot of our resources to fighting COPPA. We had some good conversations with the senators who were initially proposing the bill. We'd like to see some changes to the final version of the bill to make it a little bit more privacy protective, but it's not the threat that COSA is.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's kind of what we're seeing, too, at least from our reading of it. So for our listeners who are hearing this and maybe are a little worried about what COSA could mean, what are some actions that they could take?
Well, the big action right now is to tell your member of the House of Representatives that you want them to vote no on COSA, that you want them to oppose COSA. So the Senate has passed COSA, this combined bill. I think it was a three-bill combination. There was COSA, there was COPPA, and then Eliminate Useless Reports is the vehicle of the bill. And so it's passed. So it's gotten sent over to the House. So the House could take it up and put it on the floor at any point. And if the House passes it as the Senate passed it, it gets sent to the president, who is definitely going to sign it because he's been pushing for COSA as well. The House has a different version, a slightly different version of COSA that they've introduced over there. And so there's been talk of doing their own markup, their own process over there. But either way, the House has to take action in order for COSA to become law. So if a bunch of people start emailing or calling, email is fine. You don't actually have to talk to a person. You can email your representative and just make sure that you know that they know that you want them to oppose COSA. We can stop it in the House.
Gotcha.
And then we'll have to stop it again next Congress, because this is definitely coming back. So it stop it like, now, but we have to stop it again later, too. Don't forget that
part. It's a zombie that keeps getting revived. And yeah, I'm hoping like the pushback from you all and from the ACLU is something that politicians are going to be paying attention to. So India McKinney, thank you so much for chatting with us. And where can people find your work on the internet these days?
So we are at EFF.org. And so there's a bunch of stuff about COSA. There's a bunch of stuff about privacy. The pieces that I write tend to be really focused on process in Congress, since that's what I do. But there's a lot of really good information about a bunch of the bills that we're working on. And if you want to take action on, you know, we have a handy tool in our Action Center. That would be act.eff.org. And if you go to that website, the first thing that you will see is a big red button that says take action against COSA.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Moving on to some other news. Another story that I missed while I was out on vacation was apparently the entire internet around the world, or at least many, many PCs and devices, ended up being shut down because of the CrowdStrike outage. CrowdStrike is a company that offers like online security protections and cloud protections to companies. Their job is to prevent outages like this. And because of a bug in CrowdStrike's a recent update that they did, it ended up crashing 8.5 million Windows machines around the world, which has affected corporations like Delta. A whole bunch of folks. I just saw the news this morning. Delta says that the CrowdStrike issues, which led to delays for days on end, like even after CrowdStrike fixed the problem, people in the Atlanta airport, where the major Delta hub, were stuck there for 3 or 4 days, unable to rebook flights. People were living in the airport for several days. Delta says this whole issue cost them about $500 million. So kind of a big mess. Sherlyn, you had some stories because of CrowdStrike?
My gosh.
Wow.
I was on a close to 20-hour flight right before CrowdStrike. Uh-huh. I think it happened while I was in the air. And then when
it's
I
not what you
landed.
Wanna hear. Yeah.
Yeah, when I landed, I found out. And my friends were all like, oh my God, you landed. Everyone's like, oh my God, like good thing you made it right before all the like drama with air travel happened. And I was like, what? Huh? I truly blissfully was unaware.
You had internet. Did you not go online like, at all on your flight?
I did, but I didn't see anything about CrowdStrike. Why was I? Actually, no. I actually managed to only keep to like fun and social stuff. Not
work. That's very
stuff.
Brave of you. I was on the beach outside of Savannah in a little beach house, and I saw this news, and like the news incoming was like widest internet outage ever. I'm like, I'm on vacation. Once again, I miss one of the big stories. But let me tell you, Sherlyn, do you remember the rise up to Y2K and like the potential
issues? Yeah, I remember. Yes.
You were around.
I thought we were all going to die. I was young enough to
Well,
be.
the stories, the media was like, oh yeah, all our computers are going to shut down, society will end, civilization will halt to a stop, right? And what ended up happening is that people were aware of the bug for a long time, and a lot of work behind the scenes by IT workers and engineers went in to preventing that. So Y2K didn't actually end up being a huge problem. This is very close to what people were expecting with the Y2K bug, which is a single bug that affects computer systems globally across multiple corporations. The problem here, and this is something we talk about sometimes, is like consolidation of the internet. So a lot of companies rely on CrowdStrike for data protection, for online cloud protection, for all sorts of stuff. A lot of companies are using this one company. So if this one company fails, it's like a cascading effect that screws everybody around it. And that's ultimately it. Like, this is such an example of us relying on a handful of companies on the internet. And it's like when AWS goes down, you know, how many companies are affected? Or, it's things like that.
So do you think we learned anything from this? Like, do you think companies are changing what they do because of this?
I don't know. I don't really know. Like, the other weird thing is that a lot of companies are incentivized to use CrowdStrike. So, like, when you're building up your IT operations or something, or startup or something, they're like, oh, everyone's using CrowdStrike, let's use CrowdStrike. And I hear from some companies, too, that they're, like, I think it's like the people working on their data side, people push CrowdStrike because it is kind of the way regulators like it. The government knows how it works. So like it ends up being the de facto solution for a lot of people because of that. So this is another example of where not having a competitive market of solutions ends up biting us in the ass. There is a good story. Southwest, everybody's favorite cheap airline, ended up avoiding the CrowdStrike outage because it's still running Windows 3.1. across its systems. Okay. Are you surprised by this?
I just find it so funny.
They got the last laugh, I guess. They got the last laugh.
I mean, they were retaining some customers because of their like very strange and bucking the trend system of like non-reserve seating, and just you get assigned a seating timing or seating order, you go in and grab whatever seat you want. So they didn't need super sophisticated seating software, I guess.
Well, don't worry, Shalyn. Windows 3.1 was enough. They've also modernized to Windows 95 on some systems. So
I gotta say though. Some part of my stories around this was I lurk on some airline subreddits, and Southwest, apparently after all of the CrowdStrike stuff, has recently announced that they are changing over to assigned seating. For at least on some level. And I guess this was a change or evolution from all of that. But Delta, like you mentioned in our podcast notes, it was royally screwed for most of the week. They were like struggling to keep back up. And I also saw a very interesting post by someone who said they were a pilot on Delta Airlines and wanted to share kind of their perspective as a crew member. And like the system situation, right? CrowdStrike outage also affected them, like in the way that like they wanted to get on flights, they wanted to fly out and help people get on planes and get to their destinations, but they could not because of the issues affecting them as well. Like this person on Reddit was saying that the system, due to the CrowdStrike outage, thought that one crew member was missing and therefore wasn't able to like let the flight go, but actually that crew member wasn't even assigned to the flight to begin with or something like that. So it just it's so deeply entrenched into all parts of a lot of the businesses that it's really important to like fallbacks and more fallbacks, right? Like I think Mark Dell in the chat says, don't just rely on multiple companies for your infrastructure. If you rely on AWS, Azure, CrowdStrike, now you're affected by every outage. So maybe diversifying has always been like,
well, that is exactly it. Like, diversify as much as you can. I ran into issues where like, I would just go to a store and they were like, sorry, we can't take credit cards today. Or we can't take Tap to Pay because our entire payment system is down because of CrowdStrike. You're going to have to swipe your credit card. So that is, it's another also example of like how delicate our modern infrastructure is. Like one stupid company, one stupid update, a very small update that triggered like all these global repercussions. What a mess.
Fallbacks.
Alternatives and other solutions. Well, let's run through some of this other news. The Democratic presidential nominee, since we last went live and recorded this podcast, is no longer Joe Biden. It's Kamala Harris. Shout out to Kamala Harris, who was just here in Atlanta, had a huge thing. Unsurprisingly, Elon Musk, the owner of X / Twitter, has been going insane online because of that. And one thing he ended up doing is sharing a doctored video, an AI doctored Harris campaign video, where she talks about being a DEI hire. She, like, in this video, the fake Kamala Harris talks badly about Joe Biden, things like that too. What is interesting about this is that I see a list of like community notes under it that are pending to be applied to this video. But if you actually look at it without clicking into that, and I don't think everybody has the ability, like it's only the people who can add community notes can see the pending stuff. Normal people will see no community notes or corrections because of that. There's no label that this is AI information. Even though I believed X has a policy that you have to clearly label AI produced media. So of course, because it's Elon Musk, he doesn't have to follow his own rules, right? He owns the site.
He also, by the way, this is even more recent of a development, took down the profile or account for WD4H, White Dudes for Harris, and then reinstated it after a lot of public outcry. But like, yeah.
They were having the White Dudes for Harris call. They were raising a lot of money. A lot of people are raising money. And because
they
of that,
they raised a lot of money.
Elon Musk was so mad. So mad. Magically, that account was deactivated. This also happened to another account. I forget which one, but another account like tied to raising money and supporting Kamala.
But like,
so, yeah.
I am echoing commentary on Reddit that I agree with, which is that, like, didn't he totally just buy Twitter because he wanted to enforce free speech for everyone, only for him?
Remember when any of these folks, especially, like, the right-wing folks who are all about free speech, they are the first ones to limit speech and censor things and change speech to their own, like, whatever they prefer instead. So
I just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to point this out. Be careful out there on Twitter, because I'm still spending time there, because that is still where a lot of the conversations are happening, right? Like, and that is where the people I trust and follow are also. I'm also on Blue Sky, I'm also on Mastodon, but I see a lot of people leaving those services and going back to Twitter because that's where the community is. And part of me is like, I don't want Elon to just like take that, you know. He can manipulate it. We're gonna be there. But yeah, there's also a story recently that Musk admitted to Jordan Peterson that he bought Twitter to get at the woke mind virus that he thinks made his daughter trans. So that is Elon Musk right now. Not a good fella, unfortunately. Just a mess. But we will have our Elon updates every week as much as we can, just pointing out all the crazy things he's into. Did you try out Apple Intelligence, Rylan? Something smarter than Elon
Musk?
Every
week we have Apple updates too, right?
Apple updates. Apple Intelligence is here in the iOS 18.1 developer beta, not any other betas, just that specific beta. But like the basic capabilities of Apple Intelligence are here. I've been playing around with it for a while. The only thing I've noticed is I really like the full screen effect for Siri. I really like it when when the whole screen border just like lights up and it's all shiny. This is like the weird, I don't know, tech aesthetic sides of me. It is so much nicer than the little Siri ball. Like, I think I just like to see that. But functionally, you can ask Siri multiple questions now. You can, I think some of the text input stuff is a little better. Have you been testing it? Have you noticed any differences, Rylan?
I have been testing iOS 18, the beta, but I haven't gotten the Apple Intelligence features just yet. I will say I'm pretty familiar with what's new in this one because I took the briefing and saw a lot of the demos. So yes, the glowing border is very nice. It's a little bit reminiscent of Google in the sense that like the color scheme is like a rainbow aesthetic. But anyway, and a new feature is that you can now type to Siri if you ever want to.
Double tap the bottom of your screen to do that. Yeah.
Which I have seen it get tripped up because tapping the bottom of your screen sometimes triggers reachability, which is where it brings the top of your screen down to the middle.
It's not a great gesture right now. I think they got
to
work
on that. Not great. Yeah. There has to be a better way to do this. I get what Apple is trying to achieve because it's putting everything within reach of your thumb, so bottom half of the screen, but there has to be something better. And then I am excited to see Genmoji, but Genmoji is not yet here. Image Playground is not yet here. But you know, we've been hype about Apple Intelligence for a bit. There's some writing-related features that are here, too. I don't know if you've tried them out. But what I have seen, and this is fun, what I've seen around threads, people have been testing out the Apple Intelligence update, is the summarizing of your notifications in mail and messages. And that is hilarious because, like, the way, I mean, I think it seems really smart, right? Like I saw one before and after where like before it would just be like Groupon deals on blah, blah, blah. It, pre-summary would just give you a preview. But with Apple Intelligence, it would just be like the coupon code for 40% off is 6 or something. Like, you know, like it just gets to the point. And that's actually pretty useful and smart.
That's how I handle my personal mail, by the way. Like I have a personal Gmail that I've had since Gmail came out, and I don't go in there and trying to clear that inbox. I just sit there and sit and watch a pile up. And in the morning, I'm like, hey, I take a glance at the inbox. Anything interesting? No, keep moving. I don't even do Marcus Rand. Yeah. I just like let it pile up because that's the only way to manage that onslaught of mail, right?
Right. It's smart. It's nice to see. So anyway, right now, because Apple Intelligence is still a developer beta, it's not as widely available as a public beta, which in both cases, you'd be running beta software. So if you were keen to try it out, definitely make sure you back up your data before installing or updating anything. But if you have tried it out, or if even if you haven't, like what feature are you most intrigued by? Let us know. podcast@engadget.com.
I will also point out the really cool Apple Intelligence glow up thing also happens in CarPlay. So like if you ask to talk to Siri in CarPlay, because CarPlay is just mirroring what is kind of your phone is projecting. So it's cool. It looks good. I just love the effect. It makes me feel like, oh, these are future assistants. This isn't just like
it's a visual refresh. It's a visual refresh. That's what everyone kind of wants. Yeah.
Feels good.
I want to play with the new lock screen and the new like grid or your app grid too.
And so the photo changes are kind of cool too. Like there's a lot of like individual cool stuff here. One question I asked Avi from Friend was just like, I feel like everybody is trying to make these AI assistants, right, that are going to be helpful and we love. And no, our AI friends, it's our smartphone, the device we rely on the most, the one that holds all of our memories and is important to our daily lives. It's our smartphone, stupid. So we keep trying to add things on top of the smartphone to like, I don't know, break out the smartphone experience. But no, it's the smartphone. It's always going to be the smartphone. Like as more AI enabled features and personalized features come to our phones, like I think the more we will like our devices. Anyway, let's move on. A couple of quick things from Google. Google's making it easier to remove explicit deepfakes from its search results. That's a good thing.
Yep.
It's also going to stop them from even appearing to in the first place, or at least do more work to stop that. So that's something good there. There's some follow-up news on Google's third-party cookies, Sherlyn. Yeah, I'm sure you have like.
Yeah, I gotta laugh at this one.
Yeah,
I've been following Google's like decision to deprecate third-party cookies from the browser and from the internet at large for a very long time.
For years, we've been writing about this. Yeah.
Right. Remember when we had, they're announcing Flock, which is Federated Learning of Clusters, if I'm not wrong.
Yes.
Then they moved to something else, another bird name. And then they did Privacy Sandbox. It was another. And then after all of that hullabaloo, I think that's how you pronounce that word.
Yes.
It decided, nah, we're not getting rid of third-party cookies and Chrome after all. And it's like Google graveyard again, you know?
I'm not surprised. Like it's Google kowtowing to advertisers, basically, to the ad industry, who don't want their lives to be made harder, ultimately.
It is that. I think the one thing that Apple does better than Google on this is that, yes, sometimes Apple takes a very long time to deliver some new feature that everyone else has been doing. But when Apple does something drastic and makes a statement like that, it tends to stick to it. And does so seemingly like thoughtfully, having thought through the process before implementing something instead of making an announcement, making all of this stuff, all of this work happen and giving a lot of people a lot of anxiety and then kind of pulling back again and yielding to advertiser pressure. I think one thing also that Apple has been good at doing is to be like, nah, don't care about letting your apps track users. You know, it's like,
because Apple's not like it's, they get part of that business, but it's not the entirety of their core business model, which is that's what
they're not as dependent on ad revenue. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I like Google's approach on some things. I think this is just strange and hilarious. I don't know that I agree or disagree just yet. I think there has to be a better way.
I would love to be in the meetings, like as they talk about all these like complicated solutions. Like, okay, how do we really get rid of third-party cookies, but also still keep making life easy for advertisers? And at the end of the day, somebody comes in and is just like, how about nah? How about we don't do anything? How about we just keep going the way we've always been going because it makes us a lot of money? That is Google today. They are not the don't be evil company. Now they seem like how about evil? It's okay.
Great. Yeah, I think I'm not as personally invested in the third-party cookie sort of situation, whether or not advertisers can serve me personalized ads as well. I am more invested in like the SEO drama and what happens with that and how our AI search results and AI, you know, generated content going to affect publishing, because that's my line of work and livelihood.
It's totally all interrelated, right? Like, it is another sign that Google's like, okay, we got you, ad industry. We got your back. Publishing industry, media, editorial industry.
What are you paying us?
Yeah. What? How can
we'll take
you
all your money
us?
Though?
Please. Anyway,
we'll take all the money you're making though.
Real quick, let's mention some stories around and gadgets. Matt Smith reviewed the Galaxy Flip 6, which looks really cool. He kind of digs it, even though he thinks Samsung's cute. Playing it safe. So I agree. It looks really cool. Samsung's also marketing them as body cams for police. So that's talk about like unintended consequences for your technology. But because the screen can flip up, I guess a police officer can put them in a front pocket and that's a body cam. I don't know. That doesn't seem standardized.
I just think it's funny because look at Samsung marketing this thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm at the risk of this episode running longer than it already is running. Quickly to shout out that basically what Apple Samsung did here is like show some like pictures and video footage of people dressed in what appear to be police uniforms. And then with the Galaxy Z Flip 6 kind of like clipped onto the pocket with the camera facing out and therefore like a body cam, right? I guess it's a good use case for a foldable. If you notice my pitch going higher is because I don't believe it. I will say I have seen the Surface Duo.
Oh, yeah.
Microsoft Surface Duo being used by Microsoft employees at like who have disabilities as a more like accessibility like friendly piece of tech or device. So there's something better that you can think about with your product, Samsung, but this doesn't seem to be it.
Yeah, yay police is basically what Samsung is doing. I want to shout out Just Condit. It wrote about Star Wars Outlaws, which is the new like open world Star Wars game that I know a lot of people are excited about. The title is I Really Want to Like Star Wars Outlaws. So I think Jess is a bit conflicted on it. Like her story is like she is not super into Star Wars recently. I really want to get Jess into Star Wars Acolyte. But this game so far, I think she had good impressions with earlier demos and now it just feels kind of big and a little aimless. I've seen other previews that were more hot on it too. So I think overall it's like a positive look at this game, but Jess has concerns. I have concerns too. I am less of a fan of big open world games these days, especially when they don't fill them up with stuff to do. So there's that. Let's move on to what we're working on. On my end, just more AI laptops are coming in. I'm coming off of vacation, so I'm going to be reviewing some of those. Sherlyn, what's up with you?
Yeah, still doing a couple of watch related things. The Galaxy Watch Ultra, I'm still testing that, as well as still spending time with the watchOS 11 beta. And then August, in case y'all didn't know, is going to be the month of Google. So that's what I mean,
that's what they say. That's what they want it to be before it's the fall of Apple, you know, or Apple's autumn, I guess, not fall of Apple.
Exactly. Yeah. Apple fall. We'll Apple see.
Fall. So big, we're prepping for all that stuff. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. What you got, Sherlyn?
All right. So this past weekend, I saw in theaters Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yay.
And I loved it.
That's good.
I liked it because I'm a Marvel fan. I watched it with someone who's not a Marvel fan and didn't enjoy it as much. I think that
Sherlyn.
I know their criticism their criticism is fair. Sorry, I lost my train of thought when you said that. Their criticism is fair in that they think that the Deadpool movie relied a little too heavily on a lot of these Marvel type tie-ins, but that was exactly what made it fun for me. So I will say that like it really depends going into this movie what sort of history you have with these franchises. If you like Wolverine, you like the X-Men, you like even the other MCU stuff,
even
you'll
pre-MCU
have a rocking
stuff
good time.
I think what
pre-MCU so much
they're like I think that's part of the fun of it too, like how long have you been on watching Marvel movies and how much have you stuck with this company? Not
I've been
through,
phase
there have
one
been bad
till,
times there yeah. have been good times. I'm talking pre-phase one, Sherlyn.
Pre-phase
I'm talking
one
about
as
10
well,
years
yes.
before
I enjoyed,
phase one is where
I really that there was one surprise.
Yeah,
I'm assuming you've seen it.
Yes.
That there was one moment that I was like
I shouted and I saw it at a critic screening and there were multiple
screamed.
Points where this is a group of like media, these are movie critics behind me, people shouting and clapping and like hurrah,
yes
hooray, we're
so
doing
good.
This hell yeah. Yeah, I
was
love
very
movie.
Excited throughout. Yeah.
Other movie,
so
I
it was
agree.
A really good time, but you need to have some like historical knowledge and appreciation for that sort of gag, I think, to be really enjoying this movie as well as I did. Yeah, good time.
Good times. I also agree there are a lot of film critics who are like, well, there's not much of a plot. There's not much of a story.
Right, exactly.
The actual character motivations are very confusing. It has a good villain.
Yes.
I do like the villain. Is played by Emma Corrin. They were in the show I'd recommended, A Murder at the End of the World, and they are just fantastic and creepy. Love them because it's sort of like they don't look like a typical villain either. Like not like a big muscly dude or a crazy alien. It's just like skinny girl with psychic powers. That's weird. That is something. I want to shout out a game. I feel like I've been waiting for a game to really hit me for a while. I have not been fully into anything, but I started playing Kunitsugami, Path of the Goddess, and gotta say, freaking love this thing. It's on Game Pass right now. It is sort of a tower defense game. It's sort of a game where you are protecting this, a priestess who has magical powers who you're trying to save. It's very much like old Japanese folklore type stuff too. So like this is a game from Capcom. It brings to mind things like Okami and some of their earlier games. But yeah, you're sort of a spiritual samurai trying to cleanse these areas. You control the villages, you give them jobs, you set up like where they stand and how they attack oncoming things. I am really digging it. I just love the systems, I love the game, and I love how kind of weird it is. It feels very much like a PlayStation 2 game, and I just kind of miss that vibe. So I'm digging it. Kunitsugami, Path of the Goddess. We'll probably be writing about it a bit in Engadget 2, so keep an eye out. And I think that's it for this week, Shirlin.
Yes, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and I podcast about movies and TV at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me the weirdest health metric you want the Galaxy Ring to track, you can send them to me. I'm at Sherlyn Low on Twitter/X, or just email me at Sherlyn@Engadget.com. Email us your thoughts about the show at podcast@Engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, because that helps people discover us. And subscribe on anything that you're listening to your podcasts on. Baby nephew.